7 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, the series American Experience will present a powerful and illuminating film called The Harvest, written and produced by Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Douglas Blackman, perhaps best known for his book Slavery by Another Name, The Reenslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II. The film tells the story of Leland, Mississippi, a former hometown of Blackman, a relatively prosperous community in the heart of Mississippi's agricultural region, an idyllic place on the surface, but beneath the surface, a somewhat troubled community, highly segregated, with most of its black population living in abject poverty. The film examines what Leland, Mississippi and its citizens experienced in 1970, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Mississippi had to desegregate its public schools once and for all. Douglas Blackman, who was white, was part of that first group of first graders to experience public school desegregated education. It's the story of what those students experienced, as well as the citizens of this small community. I want to ask you about something that's specifically said in the film early on, as we're being shown some, you know, very kind of quaint images from Leland, Mississippi, back in this day, with home movie footage of things like parades and picnics and so on. And Leland is described as a busy, growing community, a tight-knit community, a little wealthier than maybe the typical small town in that part of the country, and also seen or believed by its residents as being perhaps a little more tolerant than was often the case in the Deep South. And I'm pretty sure you're saying those words. And I'm just kind of curious about, you know, especially as you look back now, if in fact that was the case, and if so, in what way was Leland, Mississippi, a more tolerant community than we maybe sometimes found in the Deep South?
Yeah, it's interesting that you picked up on that, and that's a deliberate bit of narration at the beginning of the film that, in some respects, is my hope was that it would provoke some afterthought by in the audience, a kind of, now what did he just say kind of reaction, because what we're describing there at the very beginning of the film initially is the town as the white residents of the town perceived themselves and the way that they talked about it in the presence of a white child like me. In some respects, that's what's there. And then the film begins to talk about the other Leland, which was the black Leland, and how very different it was. But Leland was, in fact, a somewhat more tolerant place than the typical small town in rural Mississippi in the middle to the late 1960s. Now, that's a relatively low bar to say more tolerant, because, as is mentioned elsewhere in the film, there were communities nearby where very recently, you know, terrible atrocities had happened, you know, violent murders of a pastor for trying to register African-American voters a few years earlier. The murder of Emmett Till occurred not very far away. And some of the other towns within 20 or 30 miles of our town were famously violent, intolerant, hostile, cruel places toward African-Americans. There were atrocities that happened in my little town, too, things that I never heard reference to while I was a child and or in any way until I was an adult, and that I suspect most white people in the town today don't even remember ever happened, some of them. But the degree of tolerance that was there was because of something that's not ever really mentioned in the film, and that is that on the outskirts of this little town, there is a research facility, an agricultural research facility that that brought into that community a disproportionate number of better educated people, still mostly Southerners, but like my father, as mentioned at the beginning of the film, was wrapping up his PhD when he got a job at this federal research facility, and we moved to that town for him to work as a soil scientist in that Department of Agriculture facility. But that did have an effect of this several hundred people who were somewhat different from what one might expect, though still many, many of them racist in their own ways, but or to their varying degrees. But when the great challenge came of what to do at that moment of absolutely required public school integration, it did mean that there was a certain critical mass of people who had somewhat different perspectives than would have been typical in other places. Had it not been for that, I suspect that our town would have been one where the entire white population left public schools forever on the very first day, because that was the much more typical experience in a town like that in Mississippi.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Douglas Blackman, who is one of the producers and is the writer for the American Experience documentary, The Harvest, which is airing tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And the film traces the experience of those young people who were part of the very first class of public school students in Leland, Mississippi, who experienced integrated, desegregated education. So as your film spells out early on, this moment was predicated by a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which was a follow-up on a much earlier Supreme Court decision that I'm sure many people are very well acquainted with, that decision in the mid-1940s that involved the public schools of Little Rock, Arkansas, and presumably beyond. Explain, first of all, what happened in the wake of that that decision regarding Little Rock, Arkansas. What happened throughout the rest of the South, which ultimately necessitated this follow-up ruling by the Supreme Court?
Well, we generally have a somewhat mixed up view of how the end of school segregation occurred in America. We all learn, or at least we should have learned, and hopefully in places like Florida, it will still be legal to learn in the future, that there was a Supreme Court decision in 1954, Brown v. Board of Education, and that was the moment at which the Supreme Court ruled that segregation was unconstitutional, and that the notion put forward by the Supreme Court back in 1896, another famous ruling that that upheld the concept of racial segregation in public services. In 1954, the Supreme Court reverses that and finally says segregation is unconstitutional. And then there are the other famous anecdotes, like the crisis at Central High in Little Rock, Arkansas, where we all have in our mind the familiar footage of a small group of nine African-American students attempting to attend the white high school there, and the attacks on them by mobs, and the necessity of soldiers being sent in to safeguard them to be able to enter school. And then if we know a little more about that period of time, we know that similar things happened in other places, though usually with less violence. But then if we ask ourselves, well, then what exactly happened after that to get to the point that truly separate schools were over, most people really don't have a very clear idea. They may have heard about some other place that had a handful of black students go over to a white school, and that would be called when the schools there desegregated or integrated. But the reality is that all across the South, after the Brown decision, and despite whatever we may have learned about those incidents like the one in Little Rock, essentially nothing happened. That all through the rest of the 1950s and into the 1960s, every Southern state, Mississippi more dramatically than any other one, was to simply refuse to undertake any form of meaningful integration. There finally was, in the middle of the 1960s, under pressure from the federal government, there began to be very small amounts of mixing of children. Again, it was 100% that a tiny number of black students would begin attending the all-white schools. But it was still the case all the way up to 1969 that every place in the South that had ever had separate black and white school systems still had separate systems all the way up to the fall of 1969. And so there had been no meaningful integration of any kind for the 15 years after the Brown decision in 1954.
One of the things that is pretty remarkable about this decision handed down regarding the public schools of Mississippi is that schools were to desegregate and immediately. In fact, do I remember correctly that some drastic changes even occurred right in the middle of the school year? I mean, this is not something that came down the pike on July 1st, when there might have been at least some time to try to kind of figure this out. Explain kind of the abruptness, the dramatic abruptness of the timeline that we are talking about here.
Well, during those 15 years after the Brown decision in 1954, there had, of course, been endless amounts of litigation. Thousands of lawsuits had been filed against individual school districts all over the South at different times. Different plans were developed in response to those lawsuits and various court orders along the way. All of those efforts, though, year after year after year, were essentially efforts by public school systems somewhere in the South to come up with a plan that would satisfy a federal judge's definition of complying with the Brown decision, but without actually accomplishing full desegregation and combination of the schools. And so there had been all of these half measures and quarter measures and one-tenth measures that had been proposed by different school systems and different litigation. Almost always these were things that, even if they were approved by the courts, were never actually fulfilled. It was all a kind of stalling action by the Southern states and these different school districts. No sincere efforts underway anywhere in any meaningful way. And so by the time you get to the end of the 1960s, the Supreme Court at that time, which of course has become considerably more liberal in the composition of the justices as well, but the Supreme Court of the late 1960s is exhausted from all of this litigation and frustrated that there has been so much drip, drip, drip opposition and refusal, and that the Southern states have lied over and over and over again, lied to the courts about what they were going to do and their commitments and what they had done. And so finally, a set of cases reached the Supreme Court in the fall session of 1969, where 30 different school districts were under suit from a series of lawsuits organized by civil rights activists and the NCAA Legal Defense Fund. And they have filed suits against 30 different districts in Mississippi. They all arrived at the Supreme Court. Supreme Court combines them into one case, Alexander v. Holmes, and then issues a truly extraordinary ruling, and a ruling that if you looked at it by itself, out of context, you would say, wow, that was a rash decision to make, because they did, in fact, order that essentially said, enough is enough. We're not listening to any of this anymore. And they brushed aside all of the arguments raised by the southern states, by the lawyers from Mississippi, and simply said, we're done. No more delays. Integrate your schools right now. Eliminate all separate school systems that still exist and do it immediately. Close your schools at the winter break or the holiday break at Christmas, but close down the segregated systems in the middle of this school year if necessary. Combine them during the holiday break and reopen as fully integrated schools in the spring of 1970. And that's what happened in dozens and dozens and dozens of places. There were a few that held off until the following year before the big transition was made, but for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of students across the South, that enormous disruption and disruptive event occurred in the middle of the school year, and that was also the case in the town where I grew up. And then I began the first grade the following fall, in September of 1970. And so my class was the first to begin without any awareness, really, that because we were five-year-olds and six-year-olds, but to begin school with black and white kids together and go all the way in the same classroom, same teachers, same books, largely ignorant of what had occurred prior to our beginning school.
Right. I want to mention at this point that one of the things that I most appreciated about the film is how many people you talk to, including people who were teachers at the time, and you are able to talk to so many of your classmates, I mean, who were part of that first cohort. You mention, I think this is towards the very end of the film, that you've actually been gone from Leland, Mississippi quite some time. In fact, we're told that your family actually moved away from Leland even before you graduated from high school, I think. So you have been away from Leland for a long, long time, and one has the sense that you had largely lost contact with the vast majority of your classmates. How was it that you were able to track down so many of them and get their participation in this film? I mean, it's less of a surprise when you are talking to people who have returned to Leland or never left Leland, but for others who have gone on to other things in other places, how did you find them? And how did you manage to corral so many of them to share their part of this story?
Finding the classmates was, for the most part, a kind of sleuthing, the same sort of sleuthing that any of us would do, I think, trying to track down old friends from long ago through the other friends we'd stayed in touch with, or in these days, all the various ways that we can try to track people down. And also, I've had a long career in journalism. And one of the things I was always pretty good at was just finding people wherever they had ended up and for whatever purpose I needed to try to locate them. But it was a bit of a challenge of just finding people, reconnecting with them, reassuring them or trying to gauge how interested they might be in participating in something like this. And some of that is always the art of, as I'm sure you know, of interviewing people and trying to reach people at a level that is more meaningful than just the surface. But one thing that I did discover in the course of all that was that while I had a very sharp and surface level of interest and obvious motivation around the kinds of questions that the film asks, and for me, that was on me. That was more apparent, I think. But it turned out that these students, even the ones who were not aware that we had been that very first cohort, until the moment that I finally got them on the phone, you know, more than 30 years after graduation, many of them still did not know we had been the first to pass through all of that together. But the But once they did know that, almost all of them also shared a sense of confusion or curiosity about what exactly had been going on back in our childhood. Mm-hmm. They all knew at some level that we had been through something that was distinctive. They just might never have known the details. And so once I found people and once we began to have those conversations, they found their way to very thoughtful recollections and introspection about those experiences, both positive and good. And I'm glad you also mentioned that we have teachers and others in the film, because it was also important to us, especially to represent the importance of the African American schools that existed under segregation. And that's one of the more complicated elements of this whole story, in that segregation was a diabolical thing that absolutely had to come to an end, and segregated black schools were terribly under-resourced and mistreated. It basically was the law of the state of Mississippi to injure black children over and over again, and anyone who tried to not mitigate the injuries done to them stood in violation of Mississippi law in those days. Nonetheless, under those circumstances, those schools were incredibly important, and the teachers who taught in them and the administrators who managed those schools played incredibly important roles in those communities, and there was a tremendous amount of pride in the segregated schools and their athletics and their academics. And so one of the perverse contradictory things about the good of ending segregation was that it also wiped away this whole institution that had been the only refuge other than the black church for African Americans in that whole era. And there was a level of trauma associated with the destruction of those schools and their cultures and histories and that was never really accounted for in the history of how all this happened and why some of the things didn't happen in the way that, in hindsight, we wish they would have.
Right. Your film does take a moment to talk about, for instance, what was, let's call it, the black high school in Leland, Mississippi, Breech High School. And we're told, among other things, that this school indeed managed to achieve marvelous success in various athletic endeavors, despite the fact that the school didn't even have a gym. And its football field was quite primitive, and in so many other ways they were operating from a tremendous disadvantage in terms of resources. And yet they managed to be more than competitive with basically any other school in the whole state of Mississippi. And I should think that for anybody who was part of that success story, success against all odds, they had to take tremendous pride in that, and indeed the fact that, in a sense, all of that was to a point wiped away by this Supreme Court ruling and this forced desegregation. That's sort of a cost in all of this that most of us don't stop to calculate or consider.
A tremendous cost. That's exactly right, and a cost that one of many costs to African Americans. That was made that much more bitter when the response of so many white people was not to, in some fashion, recognize that cost and appreciate that cost and count it in the sort of social calculation of what would happen next, but instead to ignore that cost and ignore all of those things, and that the great majority of white people then, nonetheless, were willing to sacrifice nothing whatsoever, not even willing to contemplate any kind of effort to actually create a unified community. So not only was it a great cost, but it was a cost followed by being spit in the face by many, many white people who nonetheless thoughtlessly is too weak a word, but who simply vanished from all public education, which is also interesting in that if the people who most quickly abandoned public schools, the white people who most quickly abandoned them, were also tended to be, in a community like that, people who I suspect many of your listeners can think of parallels to them, ignoring the racism part. But the people in a small town who were most interested in high school athletics long after their children had graduated, the people who served on the school board, the people who talked publicly most often about the importance of public education, the people who might well have had a Norman Rockwell poster extolling the virtues of public education hanging up somewhere in their house. But those individuals from the 1950s and the 1960s who considered themselves the most devoted to the institution of American public schools as an equalizing, leveling force in our society, those people who loved that idea the most were the ones who most rapidly abandoned it rather than have African-American children enjoy the same benefits of such a public school system. And so they, in effect, destroyed the thing that they loved most to avoid having their children and black children in school together. And that's something that is a trauma as well that a community like Leland, Mississippi, to this day has in no way recovered from.
We're speaking with Douglas Blackman about the American Experience film airing tonight called The Harvest. One thing that is really surprising is that when you speak to some of your classmates about that very first fall semester of desegregated public education in Leland, Mississippi, again and again and again, we're told that you as youngsters had little or no awareness whatsoever that something momentous was occurring. And of course, we don't necessarily expect first graders to have any grasp whatsoever about some of the kind of overarching social movements at play and so on. But I just would have thought that somebody's parents would have, you know, been worried enough to say something to them about, you know, being careful and now it's going to be strange, or I don't know. But it just sounds like, with very few, if any, exceptions, all of you just went into this with no awareness whatsoever that this was all that big a deal, apart from the fact that you were all starting school.
There were a few of my classmates who, particularly those who, if they had older siblings who were several grades ahead, that in those sorts of situations, then there was somewhat higher possibility that they would have heard something about that something was going on. But for the most part, it's exactly as you say. That was a striking thing with interview after interview that the students just hadn't heard about these things. And I think a big part of what that was about was that even in the larger approach to all of this as it was happening, was that there was so much concern about adults of keeping the peace, so to speak, that an idea set in that we should, number one, say and do nothing that could antagonize anything under any circumstances, whatever that might mean, but also this idea that, I mean, it's not unlike the lovely but in the end perhaps naive idea expressed by Dr. King in the "I Have a Dream" speech of, you know, one of the dreams was of a day when the children of former slaves and former slave owners would hold hands together and play on the red clay hills of Georgia. This notion that, well, the adults are carrying all this baggage of the past, but if we can just put these babies into classrooms together and let them grow up unfettered by these old ideas that we adults can't get rid of, then maybe that will just solve all the problems. And in many respects, that's what when we refer to those children as the seeds that were being planted in the minds of adults at the time for some harvest of the future. I think that was the idea behind that. But it's also important to remember that, you know, at that time in 1969 and 70, it had only been a few years since two people were killed during the integration of the University of Mississippi. There had been a tremendous amount of violence, all caused by extremist white people, important to remember, but a tremendous amount of violence and social disruption had occurred. And so parents were, it was one of the things where I think that adults, to some degree, thought that just the less we talk about all this and let it ride, the more likely it will be that nothing bad will happen.
Your own story is part of this film, and that's one of the things that's really, I think, quite intriguing about this film, that, for instance, unlike the typical Ken Burns documentary, we don't have the story of Ken Burns himself sort of knit into the fabric of it. And this story is in part your story, because you yourself, the filmmaker, experienced much of what is discussed in this film. I want to give you a moment to talk about an important moment in your life. I mean, in some ways, a transformative moment that in some ways anchors this film. And this is a study project that you did, I believe, when you were in middle school, and a presentation that you ended up giving as part of perhaps some kind of academic competition, in which you researched something called Strike City, a very, very small community, maybe on the outskirts of Leland, Mississippi, that had its own very particular story. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about and why this moment was so important for you.
Well, Strike City was a place that was created by a group of African-American farm workers in 1965 when they went on strike against the plantation where those families were tenant workers, and it was just outside of town. And after the strikers refused to work, and it was a historic event, not a very well remembered one, but something that had never happened before, certainly not in Mississippi, and very rarely in all of American history had an event of that nature occurred. And so this group of families went on strike. They were immediately evicted from their homes, forced off the land, lost their jobs. The men among those families were never employed in regular work again. Anytime they got a job, even years later, once it was determined that they had been part of the strike, they would be fired from their jobs summarily. And so this was an extraordinary thing. And once the families were forced out of their homes and off the land, they then, in cooperation with some civil rights organizations, they ended up acquiring a very small piece of property out in the country, and then building some houses there and creating a place that came to be known as Strike City. And so when I come along in the seventh grade, for reasons I can't pin down anymore, I was aware of this place, and that's a surprise, mostly because no white person would ever have spoken, no white adult would have ever spoken of Strike City in the presence of a white child. It was something that had been so upsetting to the white structure of society that no child would have ever learned anything about it in any way. But somehow I was, probably because, as it turned out, some of my classmates had connections there, had either lived very near Strike City or had gone to the Head Start program there before they started school. And so somehow I became aware of it, was curious about it. And in the seventh grade in 1977, I decided to write an essay based on some research in the newspaper and other sources for a contest sponsored by the County Historical Society. And of course, that's in a place like that is in 1977, that was a group of little old white ladies, but it was the 125th anniversary of the county. So in 1977, the County Historical Society sponsored a contest in connection with the 125th anniversary of the county, that any child from any school it could write a historical essay and submit it on any topic related to the history of the county. And for some reason, I chose to write about Strike City and compose this short essay that my oldest brother typed for me and submitted it to the contest. And I won third place. And though you're in hindsight, I came to realize at a certain point that that the ladies at the Historical Society had, I think, been confused and had mistaken the topic of my essay and the fact that I came from what, in their minds, would have been an overwhelmingly black school. They probably imagined it as an all-black school. And the oddity coincidence of my last name, Blackman, I think they actually thought that I was an African-American student, and I benefited from some degree of affirmative action unwittingly in that occasion. But I wrote this essay about Strike City, and then a year later, I converted it into a speech that I gave in the town oratorical contest. And I was the winner from the junior high school at that point. And so I and two finalists from the high school then attended a meeting of the Leland Lions Club, which was the sponsor of the contest. We gave our speeches one more time to that assembled group, and then the winner was picked from that on that day. And so I gave my speech to the Lions Club with no real sense at all that I was talking about an event that even was in living. It was something that, you know, had occurred the year after I was born, more than a decade earlier, in the mind of a child. That seemed like absolutely ancient history, certainly not something that anyone would still have active feelings about. And to be honest, I think in a strange way in my mind, I actually thought that everyone involved with those events had died long before. I mean, it was like talking about the American Revolution in my mind, even though I had met and talked to the landowner against whom the workers went on strike. But so I give my speech that day, and as I recount in the film, as soon as I began talking, I could tell that something was amiss, because the men, the first, you know, 40 or 50 middle-aged white men, the men began to react in ways different from any other audience that had heard the speech. They didn't laugh at the slightly humorous places, and they were absolutely silent when I made reference to the triumphs of the civil rights movement. And of course, it had never occurred to me that the men in the room might actually include the Ku Klux Klansmen who had attacked the strikers back in 1965, but I now realize that with almost absolute certainty that some of them were. And so I got through my speech. I did not win the contest, unsurprisingly. And afterwards, the men politely filed by the three of us finalists, shaking our hands until one of them only was left, and he waited back a bit, let the others go by, and then he came up to me, didn't shake my hand, and instead he attacked and began to ask me, you know, where did you get those things, boy? Who told you all those things, boy? Did your parents fill your head with those communist ideas, boy? Over and over again, boy. And my reaction as a child, initially, as naive as it sounds, but I was a naive child in the eighth grade. At first, I tried to answer his questions as I was supposed to with any adult. And I tried to say that, well, I looked these things up in the newspaper, and I interviewed Mr. Andrews, the plantation owner. But obviously, he didn't really care about where any of that had come from. And he just kept going and going and getting louder. And I wasn't so much frightened as I was confused by why would an adult be behaving in this way to me. Though at the same time, I found adults pretty mysterious at that point in my life. And so I really wasn't all that upset. But then abruptly, my teacher, my advisor, who had sponsored my appearance in the contest, suddenly appeared and got between us and sort of chest bumped the guy and said, "What are you doing?" And he spun around and took off. And we don't mention this in the film, but I will say that in the aftermath of that event, which I still did not understand and didn't even know most of the context of that event for another 25 or 30 years, but it turned out that that was the end of the town oratorical contest, or at least the Leland Lion Club's sponsorship of it. There never again did that event occur, and it turned out that there had been, over the preceding weeks, a great deal of consternation involving the superintendent of schools and the school board over whether I would be allowed to give my speech. And my teacher at the time, quite heroically, I would say now, but a white teacher, was the person who absolutely defended my rights to give that speech and the originality of it. And I will, as an aside, I will just say that it is when there are things happening in our society today that are about not letting teachers, much less children, talk honestly about the past or explore the past, passing laws to inhibit that or to ban books or ban discussions of topics. I think back to the bravery of that one teacher of mine back in 1978 to stick up for the First Amendment is what she really was doing, and what a profound influence that had on my life. And to be honest with you, I suspect had that not happened, I would never have made this film or in prep. So
changed everything. Yeah,
quite an experience.
You also make mention of the fact that that you were on your high school's basketball team, and at least at the point that you made the team, you were the only white student on that basketball team. You don't spend a lot of time talking about this experience, but I wonder if you would just tell us a little bit about what that was like for you, and what, if anything, you learned from that experience.
It was a profound experience, and I had not tried out for the junior high basketball team in earlier years because I was kind of intimidated by the fact that it was overwhelmingly African-American players, and they all seemed to be better athletes than I was. And it sort of scared me away from trying out for the team. And so when I got to high school in the ninth grade, I vowed that I was not going to do that again, let myself be intimidated. And so I tried out for the team, and I made it, barely, I would say. I played a lot of basketball. I don't know how great I was at it, but I made it onto the team, and I was indeed the only white player. There was also a white manager, a student manager of the team, and the coach was white. In fact, the coach showed up at one of the first pre-screenings of the film recently in Mississippi, and I was very touched that he was still living and came out for that. But that experience of then traveling around the Mississippi Delta, playing other high schools that for the most part were 99% African American schools, if not 100%, and so on many occasions, it being the case that I and the coach and perhaps the manager were not just the only white people on the team, so to speak, but in the town, in effect, and certainly. And in situations where there were thousands and thousands of African-Americans there. And, I mean, I learned a lot of things about that. Like with any athletic experience, I learned a lot about becoming teammates with people who were not exactly like me. And that experience also put me into a context where while in my classes, which were grouped by the abilities of students, the performance on standardized tests. That's something else we discuss in the film. But so you tended to have that in the homeroom classes at school, that the white kids were clumped together in a couple of the classes, mixed in with other high-performing African-Americans. But on the basketball team or the football team, you were grouped by athletic ability. And so that experience of me being the absolute minority was truly a distinct one. And so, as with any team, you know, I had to adapt to the differentness of all of us, and then figure out how to work together and how to work through, a lot of interpersonal conflict and such at that time, because all of those students, black and white, were working out their emotional responses to the world having been turned upside down in our childhoods. And so, you know, we had to get through all of those things and figure out how to play. I wish that the end of the story was a Hoosiers win, that where I could say we figured it out and won the state championship. But that didn't happen my year, but over the next few years, a version of that did.
So as we get to the end of the film, and you are looking at Leland, Mississippi today, there are many ways in which this, if one might call it, you know, kind of a grand experiment, in some ways was a failure. It did not change the face of Leland, Mississippi and the schools there in the way that might have been hoped. And yet your film calls us to not jump to conclusions about whether or not all of this was a failure. And in fact, you find reason to regard what was done in Leland as something that bore fruit. And that's, the reason for the title being The Harvest. Just in a nutshell, what are some of the kernels of hope that we find in this story?
At the end of the film, we really ask the question without ever saying the exact words, but we ask the question, was it all worth it? Was everything that all of those kids went through, was everything that the town went through, was everything that America went through, all of the difficulty and struggle and work that did occur, you know, was it worth it, given that in the end, the schools today are, you essentially have 100% black public schools and 100% white private schools. And so was it really worth it to go through all of that, given where we ended up? And in an even bigger way, I would say, was it worth it for our whole society, that we have done so much, we've changed so much over the last 50 years and the last 30 years, and yet what happened to George Floyd still happens. And yet, at any given time, a city in America can explode with disturbances and violence and things that tell us that no progress at all has been made. And so that is the question. Has it been worth it, and why? Why this paradox that after so much progress in other ways, where we love each other across race if we choose to, we live together, we work together, all of these things that seem so successful in our society, and yet we are so fragile, so ready to be set back at almost any time. Why is that? And given where we are, was it worth it to have done all the things that we did and experienced and endured what we did? And the answer to that, I would say, is for everyone to find their own answer. But I think as you get to the end of the film, that my answer would be yes. Yes, it was worth it. It was absolutely worth it, because while we did not achieve anything even remotely close to what Dr. King painted, that picture he painted in 1963, we have not achieved that or the beloved community by any stretch of imagination, but we did accomplish many, many things. And I think that viewers will see, as we reach the end of the film, in the individual lives of my classmates, they will see so many of those accomplishments. And so I think that the lesson ultimately for me is that it is not that we shouldn't have done the things that were done. It's that we didn't do enough. We gave up as a society too soon. And the things that we were trying to do, we stopped simply because they became too hard for too many people. And we lost a sense of moral urgency that for just a moment motivated people like my parents, the still imperfect people, but motivated good people to try to do the right thing.
Douglas Blackman's film, The Harvest, airs tonight on Channel 10 in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. I'm Gregory Berg. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and classical music on your gateway to